They came to where the miners were extending the old tunnel. There the wizard spoke with Licky in the flare of candles among jagged shadows. He touched the earth at the tunnel's end, took clods of earth in his hands, rolled the dirt in his palms, kneading, testing, tasting it. For that time he was silent, and Otter watched him with staring intensity, still trying to understand. Licky came back to the barracks with them. Gellick bade Otter good night in his soft voice. Licky shut him as usual into the brick-walled room, giving him a loaf of bread, an onion, a jug of water. Otter crouched as always in the uneasy oppression of the spellbond. He drank thirstily. The sharp, earthy taste of the onion was good, and he ate it all. As the dim light that came into the room from chinks in the mortar of the bricked-up window died away, instead of sinking into the blank misery of all his nights in that room, he stayed awake, and growing more awake. The excited turmoil of his mind all the time he had been with Gellick slowly quieted. From it, something rose, coming close, coming clear. The image he had seen down in the mine, shadowy yet distinct. The slave in the high vault of the tower, that woman with empty breasts and festered eyes, who spat the spittle that ran from her poisoned mouth and wiped her mouth and stood waiting to die. She had looked at him. He saw her very clearly, more clearly than he had seen her in the tower. He saw her more clearly than he had ever seen anyone. He saw the thin arms, the swollen joints of elbow and wrist, the childish nape of her neck. It was as if she was with him in the room. It was as if she was in him, as if she was him. She looked at him. He saw her look at him. He saw himself through her eyes. He saw the lines of the spells that held him, heavy cords of darkness, a tangled maze of lines all about him. There was a way out of the knot. If he turned around so, and then so, and parted the lines with his hands, so, and he was free. He could not see the woman anymore. He was alone in the room, standing free. All the thoughts he had not been able to think for days and weeks were racing through his head, a storm of ideas and feelings, a passion of rage, vengeance, pity, pride. At first he was overwhelmed with fierce fantasies of power and revenge. He would free the slaves. He would spellbind Gellick and hurl him into the refining fire. He would bind him and blind him and leave him to breathe the fumes of quicksilver in that highest vault till he died. But when his thoughts settled down and began to run clearer, he knew that he could not defeat a wizard of great craft and power, even if that wizard was mad. If he had any hope, it was to play on his madness and lead the wizard to defeat himself. He pondered. All the time he was with Gellick, he had tried to learn from him, tried to understand what the wizard was telling him, yet he was certain now that Gellick's ideas, the teaching he so eagerly imparted, had nothing to do with his power or with any true power. Mining and refining were indeed great crafts with their own mysteries and masteries, but Gellick seemed to know nothing of those arts. His talk of the All King and the Red Mother was mere words, and not the right words. But how did Otter know that? In all his flood of talk, the only word Gellick had spoken in the old tongue, the language of which wizard spells were made, was the word Turris. He had said it meant semen. Otter's own gift of magery had recognized that word as the true word. Gellick had also said it meant quicksilver, and Otter knew he was wrong. His humble teachers had taught him all the words they knew of the language of the making. Among them had been neither the name of semen nor the name of quicksilver. But his lips parted, his tongue moved. Ayazur, he said. His voice was the voice of the slave in the stone tower. It was she who knew the true name of quicksilver and spoke it through him. Then for a while he held still, body and mind, beginning to understand for the first time where his power lay. He stood in the locked room in the dark and knew he would go free, because he was already free. A storm of praise ran through him. After a while, deliberately, he re-entered the trap of bond spells, went back to his old place, sat down on the pallet, and went on thinking. The prisoning spell was still there, yet it had no power over him now. He could walk into it and out of it as if it were mere lines painted on the floor. Gratitude for this freedom beat in him as steady as his heartbeat. He thought what he must do and how he must do it. He wasn't sure whether he had summoned her or she had come of her own will. He didn't know how she had spoken the word of the old tongue to him or through him. He didn't know what he was doing or what she was doing, and he was almost certain that the working of any spell would rouse Gellick. But at last, rashly and in dread, for such spells were a mere rumor among those who had taught him sorcery, he summoned the woman in the stone tower. He brought her into his mind and saw her as he had seen her there in that room, and he called out to her, and she came. Her apparition stood again just outside the spider-web cords of the spell, gazing at him and seeing him, for a soft, bluish, sourceless light filled the room. Her sore, raw lips quivered, but she did not speak. He spoke, giving her his true name. "I am Medra."
"I am Anyeb,"
she whispered. "How can we get free?"
"His name."
"Even if I knew it, when I'm with him I can't speak."
"If I was with you, I could use it."
"I can't call you."
"But I can come," she said.
She looked round and he looked up. Both knew that Gellick had sensed something, had wakened. Otter felt the bonds close and tighten, and the old shadow fall.
"I will come, Medra," she said.
She held out her thin hand in a fist, then opened it, palm up, as if offering him something. Then she was gone. The light went with her. He was alone in the dark. The cold grip of the spells took him by the throat and choked him, bound his hands, pressed on his lungs. He crouched, gasping. He could not think, he could not remember. "Stay with me," he said, and did not know who he spoke to. He was frightened, and did not know what he was frightened of. The wizard, the power, the spell. It was all darkness. But in his body, not in his mind, burned a knowledge he could not name any more, a certainty that was like a tiny lamp held in his hands in a maze of caverns underground. He kept his eyes on that seed of light. Weary, evil dreams of suffocation came to him, but took no hold on him. He breathed deep. He slept at last. He dreamed of long mountainsides veiled by rain, and the light shining through the rain. He dreamed of clouds passing over the shores of islands, and a high green hill that stood in mist and sunlight at the end of the sea. The wizard who called himself Gellick and the pirate who called himself King Losin had worked together for years, each supporting and increasing the other's power, each in the belief that the other was his servant. Gellick was sure that without him, Losin's rubbishy kingdom would soon collapse, and some enemy mage would rub out its king with half a spell. But he let Losin act the master. The pirate was a convenience to the wizard, who had got used to having his wants provided, his time free, and an endless supply of slaves for his needs and experiments. It was easy to keep up the protections he had laid on Losin's person and expeditions and forays, the prisoning spells he had laid on the places slaves worked or treasures were kept. Making those spells had been a different matter, a long, hard work. But they were in place now, and there wasn't a wizard in all Havnor that could undo them. Gellick had never met a man he feared. A few wizards had crossed his path strong enough to make him wary of them, but he had never known one with skill and power equal to his own. Of late, entering always deeper into the mysteries of a certain lore book brought back from the Isle of Wight by one of Losin's raiders, Gellick had become indifferent to most of the arts he had learned or had discovered for himself. The book had proved to him that all of them were only shadows or hints of a greater mastery. As one true element controlled all substances, one true knowledge contained all others. Approaching ever closer to that mastery, he understood that the crafts of wizards were as crude and false as Lawson's title and rule. When he was one with the true element, he would be the one true king. Alone among men, he would speak the words of making and unmaking. He would have dragons for his dogs. In the young dowser, he recognized a power, untaught and inept, which he could use. He needed much more quicksilver than he had. Therefore, he needed a finder. Finding was a base skill. Gellick had never practiced it, but he could see that the young fellow had the gift. He would do well to learn the boy's true name, so that he could be sure of controlling him. He sighed at the thought of the time he must waste teaching the boy what he was good for. And after that, the ore must still be dug out of the earth and the metal refined. As always, Gellick's mind leapt across obstacles and delays to the wonderful mysteries at the end of them. In the lore book from Wei, which he brought with him in a spell-sealed box whenever he traveled, were passages concerning the true refiner's fire. Having long studied these, Gellick knew that once he had enough of the pure metal, the next stage was to refine it yet further into the body of the moon. He had understood the disguised language of the book to mean that in order to purify pure quicksilver, the fire must be built not of mere wood, but of human corpses. Rereading and pondering the words this night in his room in the barracks, he discerned another possible meaning in them. There was always another meaning in the words of this lore. Perhaps the book was saying that there must be sacrifice not only of base flesh, but of inferior spirit. The great fire in the tower should burn not dead bodies, but living ones, living and conscious, purity from foulness, bliss from pain. It was all part of the great principle, perfectly clear once seen. He was sure he was right, had at last understood the technique. But he must not hurry. He must be patient, must make certain. He turned to another passage and compared the two, and brooded over the book late into the night. Once, for a moment, something drew his mind away, some invasion of the outskirts of his awareness. The boy was trying some trick or other. Gellick spoke a single word impatiently and returned to the marvels of the All-King's realm. He never noticed that his prisoner's dreams had escaped him. The next day he had Licky send him the boy. He looked forward to seeing him, to being kind to him, teaching him, petting him a bit as he had done yesterday. He sat down with him in the sun. Gellick was fond of children and animals. He liked all beautiful things. It was pleasant to have a young creature about. Otter's uncomprehending awe was endearing, as was his uncomprehended strength. Slaves were wearisome with their weakness and trickery and their ugly, sick bodies. Of course, Otter was his slave, but he need not know it. They could be teacher and prentice. But prentices were faithless, Gellick thought, reminded of his prentice early, too clever by half, whom he must remember to control more strictly. Father and son. That's what he and Otter could be. He would have the boy call him father. He recalled that he had intended to find out his true name. There were various ways of doing it, but the simplest, since the boy was already under his control, was to ask him, "What is your name?" he said, watching Otter intently. There was a little struggle in the mind, but the mouth opened and the tongue moved. Medra. Very good, Medra, said the wizard. You may call me father. You must find the Red Mother, he said. They were sitting side by side again outside the barracks. The autumn sun was warm. The wizard had taken off his conical hat, and his thick gray hair flowed loose about his face. I know you found that little patch for them to dig, but there's no more in that than a few drops. It's scarcely worth burning for so little. If you are to help me, and if I am to teach you, you must try a little harder. I think you know how. He smiled at Otter. Don't you? Otter nodded. He was still shaken, appalled by the ease which Gellick had forced him to say his name, which gave the wizard immediate and ultimate power over him. Now he had no hope of resisting Gellick in any way. That night he had been in utter despair. But then Anyeb had come into his mind, come of her own will, by her own means. He could not summon her, could not even think of her, and would not have dared to do so while he was with Gellick. But she came and was present in his mind. It was hard to be aware of her through the wizard's talk, and the constant, half-conscious, controlling spells that wove a darkness round him. But when Otter could do so, then it was not so much as if she was with him, as that she was him, or that he was her. He saw through her eyes. Her voice spoke in his mind, stronger and clearer than Gellick's voice and spells. Through her eyes and mind he could see and think, and he began to see that the wizard, completely certain of possessing him body and soul, was careless of the spells that bound Otter to his will. A bond is a connection. He, or Anyeb, within him, could follow the links of Gellick's spells back into Gellick's own mind. Oblivious to all of this, Gellick talked on, following the endless spell of his own enchanting voice. "You must find the true womb, the belly bag of the earth that holds the pure moon seed. Did you know that the moon is the earth's father? Yes. And he lay with her, as is the father's right. He quickened her base clay with the true seed. But she will not give birth to the king. She is strong in her fear and willful in her vileness. She holds him back and hides him deep, fearing to give birth to her master. That is why, to give him birth, she must be burned alive." Gellick stopped and said nothing for some time, thinking, his face excited. Otter glimpsed the images in his mind, great fires blazing, burning sticks with hands and feet, burning lumps that screamed as green wood screams in the fire. "Yes," he said, his deep voice soft and dreamy, "she must be burned alive, and then, only then, will he spring forth shining. Oh, it's time and past time. We must deliver the king. We must find the great load. It is here, there is no doubt of that. The womb of the mother lies under Samore." Again he paused. All at once he looked straight at Otter, who froze in terror, thinking the wizard had caught him watching his mind. Gellick stared at him a while with that curious, half-keen, half-unseeing gaze, smiling.
"Little Medra," he said,
as if just discovering he was there, and patted Otter's shoulder. "I know you have the gift of finding what's hidden. Quite a great gift, were it suitably trained. Have no fear, my son. I know why you led my servants only to the little load, playing and delaying. But now that I've come, you serve me, and have nothing to be afraid of, and there's no use trying to conceal anything from me, is there? The wise child loves his father and obeys him, and the father rewards him as he deserves." He leaned very close, as he liked to do, and said gently, confidentially, "I'm sure you can find the great load." "I know where it is," Anyeb said. Otter could not speak, but she spoke through him. His voice was thick and faint. Very few people ever spoke to Gellick unless he compelled them to do so. The spells by which he controlled, weakened, and silenced all who approached him were so habitual to him that he gave them no thought. He was used to being listened to, not to listening. Serene in his strength and obsessed with his ideas, he had no thought beyond them. He was not aware of Otter at all except as part of his plans, an extension of himself. "Yes, yes, you will," he said, and smiled again. But Otter was intensely aware of Gellick, both physically and as a presence of immense controlling power, and it seemed to him that Anyeb's speaking had taken away that much of Gellick's power over him, gaining him a place to stand, a foothold. Even with Gellick so close to him, fearfully close, he managed to speak. "I will take you there," he said, stiffly, laboriously. Gellig was used to hearing people say the words he had put in their mouth, if they said anything at all. These were the words he wanted, but he had not expected to hear. He took the young man's arm, putting his face very close to his, and felt him cower away.
"How clever you are," he said. "Have you found better ore than that patch you found first? Worth the digging and the roasting?"
"It is the load," the young man said. The slow, stiff words carried great weight.
"The great load?"
Gellig looked straight at him, their faces not a hand's breadth apart. The light in his bluish eyes was like the soft, crazy shift of quicksilver.
"The womb?"
"Only the master can go there."
"What master?"
"The master of the house, the king." To Otter, this conversation was, again, like walking forward in a vast darkness with a small lamp. Anyeb's understanding was that lamp. Each step revealed the next step he must take, but he could never see the place where he was. He did not know what was coming next, and did not understand what he saw, but he saw it and went forward, word by word.
"How do you know of that house?"
"I saw it."
"Where? Near here?"
Otter nodded. "Is it in the earth?"
"Tell him what he sees," Anyeb whispered in Otter's mind, and he spoke.
"A stream runs through darkness over a glittering roof. Under the roof is the house of the king. The roof stands high above the floor, on high pillars. The floor is red, all the pillars are red. On them are shining runes."
Gellig caught his breath.
Presently, he said, very softly,
"Can you read the runes?"
"I cannot read them." Otter's voice was toneless. "I cannot go there. No one can enter there in the body, but only the king. Only he can read what is written." Gellick's white face had gone whiter. His jaw trembled a little. He stood up suddenly, as he always did.
"Take me there,"
he said, trying to control himself, but so violently compelling Otter to get up and walk that the young man lurched to his feet and stumbled several steps, almost falling. Then he walked forward, stiff and awkward, trying not to resist the coercive, passionate will that hurried his steps. Gellig pressed close beside him, often taking his arm.
"This way," he said several times.
"Yes, yes, this is the way." Yet he was following Otter. His touch and his spells pushed him, rushed him, but in the direction Otter chose to go. They walked past the roaster tower, past the old shaft and the new one, on into the long valley where Otter had taken Licky the first day he was there. It was late autumn now. The shrubs and scrubby grass that had been green that day were done and dry, and the wind rattled the last leaves on the bushes. To their left, a little stream ran low among willow thickets. Mild sunlight and long shadows streaked the hillsides. Otter knew that a moment was coming when he might get free of Gellig. Of that he had been sure since last night. He also knew that in that same moment he might defeat Gellig, disempower him, if the wizard, driven by his visions, was vulnerable, and if Otter could learn his name. The wizard's spells still bound their minds together. Otter pressed rashly forward into Gellig's mind, seeking his true name, but he did not know where to look or how to look. A finder who did not know his craft, all he could see clearly in Gellig's thoughts were pages of a lore book full of meaningless words and the vision he had described. A vast red-walled palace where silver runes danced on the crimson pillars. But Otter could not read the book or the runes. He had never learned to read. All this time, he and Gellig were going on farther from the tower, away from Anyeb, whose presence sometimes weakened and faded, and whom Otter dared not try to summon. Only a few steps ahead of them now was the place where underfoot, underground, 2 or 3 feet down, dark water crept and seeped through soft earth over the ledge of mica. Under that opened the hollow cavern and the load of cinnabar. Gellig was almost wholly absorbed in his own vision, But since Otter's mind and his were connected, he saw something of what Otter saw. He stopped, gripping Otter's arm. His hand shook with eagerness. Otter pointed to the slope that rose before them. "The king's house is there," he said. Gellick's attention turned entirely away from him then, fixed on the hillside and the vision he saw within it. Then Otter could call to Anyeb. At once she came into his mind and being and was there with him. Gellick was standing still, but his shaking hands were clenched, his whole tall body twitching and trembling, like a hound that wants to chase but cannot find the scent. He was at a loss. There was the hillside with its grass and bushes and the last of the sunlight, but there was no entrance. Grass growing out of gravelly dirt, the seamless earth. Although Otter had not thought the words, Anyeb spoke with his voice, the same weak, dull voice. "Only the master can open the door. Only the king has the key."
"The key,"
Gellick said. Otter stood motionless, effaced, as Anyeb had stood in the room in the tower.
"The key,"
Gellick repeated, urgent.
"The key is the king's name." That was a leap in the darkness. Which one of them had said it?
Gellick stood tense and trembling, still at a loss.
"Tures,"
he said, after a time, almost in a whisper. The wind blew in the dry grass. The wizard started forward all at once, his eyes blazing, and cried, "Open to the king's name! I am Tinaral!" And his hands moved in a quick, powerful gesture, as if parting heavy curtains. The hillside in front of him trembled, writhed, and opened. A gash in it deepened, widened. Water sprang up out of it and ran across the wizard's feet. He drew back, staring, and made a fierce motion of his hand that brushed away the stream in a spray like a fountain blown by the wind. The gash in the earth grew deeper, revealing the ledge of mica. With a sharp, rending crack, the glittering stones split apart. Under it was darkness. The wizard stepped forward.
"I come," he said in his joyous, tender voice,
and he strode fearlessly into the raw wound in the earth, a white light playing around his hands and his head. But seeing no slope or stair downward, as he came to the lip of the broken roof of the cavern, he hesitated. And in that instant, Anyeb shouted in Otter's voice, "Tinaral, fall!" Staggering wildly, the wizard tried to turn, lost his footing on the crumbling edge, and plunged down into the dark, his scarlet cloak billowing up, the werelight round him like a falling star.
"Close!"
Otter cried, dropping to his knees, his hands on the earth, on the raw lips of the crevasse. "Close, mother! Be healed, be whole!" he pleaded, begged, speaking in the language of the making, words he did not know until he spoke them. "Mother, be whole," he said. And the broken ground groaned and moved, drawing together, healing itself. A reddish seam remained, a scar through the dirt and gravel and uprooted grass. The wind rattled the dry leaves on the scrub oak bushes. The sun was behind the hill, and clouds were coming over in a low gray mass. Otter crouched there at the foot of the hill slope, alone. The clouds darkened. Rain passed through the little valley, falling on the dirt and the grass. Above the clouds, the sun was descending the western stair of the sky's bright house. Otter sat up at last. He was wet, cold, bewildered. Why was he here? He had lost something and had to find it. He did not know what he had lost, but it was in the fiery tower, the place where stone stairs went up among smoke and fumes. He had to go there. He got to his feet and shuffled, lame and unsteady, back down the valley. He had no thought of hiding or protecting himself. Luckily for him, there were no guards about. There were few guards, and they were not on the alert, since the wizard's spells had kept the prison shut. The spells were gone, but the people in the tower did not know it, working on under the greater spell of hopelessness. Otter passed the dome chamber of the roaster pit and its hurrying slaves, and climbed slowly up the circling, darkening, reeking stairs
till he came to the topmost room. She was there, the sick woman who could heal him, the poor woman who held the treasure, the stranger who was himself. He stood silent in the doorway. She sat on the stone floor near the crucible, her thin body grayish and dark like the stones. Her chin and breasts were shiny with a spittle that ran from her mouth. He thought of the spring of water that had run from the broken earth.
"Medra," she said.
Her sore mouth could not speak clearly. He knelt down and took her hands, looking into her face.
"Anyet," he whispered, "come with me." "I want to go home," she said.
He helped her stand. He made no spell to protect or hide them. His strength had been used up. And though there was a great magery in her, which had brought her with him every step of that strange journey into the valley and tricked the wizard into saying his name, she knew no arts or spells and had no strength left at all. Still, no one paid attention to them, as if a charm of protection was on them. They walked past the barracks, away from the mines. They walked through thin woodlands towards the foothills that hid Mount On from the lowlands of Samore. Anyeb kept a better pace than seemed possible in a woman so famished and destroyed, walking almost naked in the chill of the rain. All her will was aimed on walking forward. She had nothing else in her mind, not him, not anything. But she was there bodily with him, and he felt her presence as keenly and strangely as when she had come to his summoning. The rain ran down her naked head and body. He made her stop to put on his shirt. He was ashamed of it, for it was filthy, he having worn it all these weeks. She let him pull it over her head, and then walked on. She could not go quickly, but she went steadily, her eyes fixed on the faint cart track they followed, till the night came early under the rain clouds, and they could not see where to set their feet.
"Make the light," she said.
Her voice was a whimper, plaintive.
"Can't you make the light?"
"I don't know," he said. But he tried to bring the ware-light round them, and after a while the ground glimmered faintly before their feet. "We should find shelter and rest," he said.
"I can't stop," she said,
and started to walk again.
"You can't walk all night." "If I lie down, I won't get up. I want to see the mountain."
Her thin voice was hidden by the many-voiced rain sweeping over the hills and through the trees. They went on through darkness, seeing only the track before them in the dim silvery glow of the ware-light shot through by silver lines of rain. When she stumbled, he caught her arm. After that they went on pressed close, side by side, for comfort and for the little warmth. They walked slower, and yet slower, but they walked on. There was no sound but the sound of the rain falling from the black sky, and the little kissing squelch of their sodden feet in the mud and wet grass of the track.
"Look,"
she said, halting.
"Medra, look."
He had been walking almost asleep. The pallor of the ware-light had faded, drowned in a fainter, faster clarity. Sky and earth were all one gray, but before them and above them, very high, over a drift of cloud, the long ridge of the mountain glimmered red.
"There,"
Anyeb said. She pointed at the mountain and smiled. She looked at her companion, then slowly down at the ground. She sank down kneeling. He knelt with her, tried to support her, but she slid down in his arms. He tried to keep her head, at least, from the mud of the track. Her limbs and face twitched, her teeth chattered. He held her close against him, trying to warm her.
"The women," she whispered, "of the hand, ask them in the village. I did see the mountain."
She tried to sit up again, looking up, but the shaking and shuddering seized her and racked her. She began to gasp for breath. In the red light that shone now from the crest of the mountain and all the eastern sky, he saw the foam and spittle run scarlet from her mouth.
Sometimes she clutched at him, but she did not speak again. She fought her death, fought to breathe, while the red light faded and then darkened into gray as clouds swept again across the mountain and hid the rising sun. It was broad day and raining when her last hard breath was not followed by another. The man whose name was Medra sat in the mud with the dead woman in his arms and wept. A carter walking at his mule's head with a load of oak wood from Farian Forest came upon them and took them both to Wood Edge. He could not make the young man let go of the dead woman. Weak and shaky as he was, he would not set his burden down on the load, but clambered into the cart holding her, and held her all the miles to Wood Edge. All he said was, "She saved me," and the carter asked no questions. "She saved me, but I could not save her," he said fiercely to the men and women of the mountain village. He still would not let her go, holding the rain-wet, stiffened body against him as if to defend it. Very slowly, they made him understand that one of the women was Anyeb's mother, and that he should give Anyeb to her to hold. He did so at last, watching to see if she was gentle with his friend and would protect her. Then he followed another woman meekly enough. He put on dry clothing she gave him to put on, and ate a little food she gave him to eat, and lay down on the pallet she led him to, and sobbed in weariness, and slept. In a day or two, some of Licky's men came asking if anyone had seen or heard tell of the great wizard Gellick and a young finder. Both disappeared without a trace, they said, as if the earth had swallowed them. Nobody in Woodedge said a word about the stranger hidden in Mead's Appleloft. They kept him safe. Maybe that is why the people there now call their village not Woodedge, as it used to be, but Otterhide. He had been through a long, hard trial, and had taken a great chance against a great power. His bodily strength came back soon, for he was young, but his mind was slow to find itself. He had lost something, lost it forever, lost it as he found it. He sought among memories, among shadows, groping over and over through images, the assault on his home in Havnor, the stone cell and hound, the brick cell in the barracks and the spell bonds there, walking with Licky, sitting with Gellig, the slaves, the fire, the stone stairs winding up through the fumes and smoke to the high room in the tower. He had to regain it all, to go through it all, searching. Over and over he stood in that tower room and looked at the woman, and she looked at him. Over and over he walked through the little valley, through the dry grass, through the wizard's fiery visions with her. Over and over he saw the wizard fall, saw the earth close. He saw the red ridge of the mountain in the dawn. Anyeb died while he held her, her ruined face against his arm. He asked her who she was, and what they had done, how they had done it, but she could not answer him. Her mother, Ayo, and her mother's sister, Mead, were wise women. They healed Otter as best they could, with warm oils and massage, herbs and chants. They talked to him and listened when he talked. Neither of them had any doubt but that he was a man of great power. He denied this. "I could have done nothing without your daughter," he said. "What did she do?" Ayo asked softly. He told her, as well as he could. "We were strangers, yet she gave me her name," he said, "and I gave her mine." He spoke haltingly, with long pauses. "It was I that walked with the wizard, compelled by him, but she was with me, and she was free. And so together we could turn his power against him, so that he destroyed himself." He thought for a long time and said, "She gave me her power." "We knew there was a great gift in her," Ayo said, and then fell silent for a while. "We didn't know how to teach her. There are no teachers left on the mountain. King Losin's wizards destroyed the sorcerers and witches. There's no one to turn to." "Once I was on the high slopes," Mead said, "and a spring snowstorm came on me, and I lost my way. She came there. She came to me.
not in the body, and guided me to the track. She was only 12 then.
She walked with the dead sometimes, Io said very low, in the forest, down towards Faliern. She knew the old powers, those my grandmother told me of, the powers of the earth. They were strong there, she said.
But she was only a girl like the others too, Mead said, and hid her face.
A good girl, she whispered.
After a while, Io said, she went down to Fern with some of the young folk to buy fleece from the shepherds there a year ago last spring. That wizard they spoke of came there casting spells, taking slaves.
Then they were all silent.
Io and Mead were much alike, and Otter saw in them what Anya might have been, a short, slight, quick woman with a round face and clear eyes, and a mass of dark hair, not straight like most people's hair, but curly, frizzy. Many people in the west of Havnor had hair like that. But Anyeb had been bald, like all the slaves in the Roaster Tower. Her youth name had been Flag, the blue iris of the springs. Her mother and aunt called her Flag when they spoke of her. Whatever I am, whatever I can do, it's not enough, he said.
It's never enough, Mead said.
And what can anyone do alone? She held up her first finger, then raised the other fingers and clenched them together into a fist, then slowly turned her wrist and opened her hand, palm out, as if in offering. He had seen Anyeb make that gesture. It was not a spell, he thought, watching intently, but a sign. Io was watching him.
It's a secret, she said.
Can I know the secret? He asked after a while.
You already know it. You gave it to Flag. She gave it to you.
Trust.
Trust,
the young man said.
Yes, but against them? Gellick's gone. Maybe Losin will fall now. Will it make any difference? Will the slaves go free? Will beggars eat? Will justice be done?
I think there's an evil in us, in mankind. Trust denies it, leaps across it, leaps the chasm, but it's there. And everything we do finally serves evil, because that's what we are, greed and cruelty. I look at the world, at the forest, and the mountain here, the sky, and it's all right, as it should be. But we aren't. Men aren't. We're wrong. We do wrong. No animal does wrong. How could they? But we can, and we do. And we never stop.
They listened to him, not agreeing, not denying, but accepting his despair.
His words went into their listening silence and rested there for days and came back to him changed.
We can't do anything without each other, he said.
But it's the greedy ones, the cruel ones, who hold together and strengthen each other, and those who won't join them stand each alone.
The image of Anya, as he had first seen her, a dying woman standing alone in the tower room, was always with him.
Real power goes to waste. Every wizard uses his arts against the others, serving the men of greed. What good can any art be used that way? It's wasted. It goes wrong, or it's thrown away, like slaves' lives. Nobody can be free alone, not even a mage. All of them working their magic in prison cells to gain nothing. Nothing changes. There's no way to use power for good.
Io closed her hand and opened it palm up, a fleeting sketch of a gesture, of a sign.
A man came up the mountain to Wood Edge, a charcoal burner from Fern. My wife Nesty sends a message to the wise women, he said, and the villagers showed them to Io's house.
As he stood in the doorway, he made a hurried motion. A fist turned to an open palm.
Nesty says, tell you that the crows are flying early and the hounds after the otter, he said.
Otter, sitting by the fire shelling walnuts, held still.
Mead thanked the messenger and brought him in for a cup of water and a handful of shelled nuts. She and Io chatted with him about his wife. When he had gone, she turned to Otter.
The hound serves Losin, he said. I'll go today.
Mead looked at her sister. Then it's time we talk to you a bit,
she said, sitting down across the hearth from him. Io stood by the table, silent. A good fire burned in the hearth. It was a wet, cold time, and firewood was one thing they had plenty of here on the mountain.
There's people all over these parts, and maybe beyond, who think, as you said, that nobody can be wise alone. So these people try to hold to each other. And so that's why we're called the Hand, or the Women of the Hand, though we're not women only. But it serves to call ourselves women, for the great folk don't look for women to work together, or to have thoughts about such things as rule or misrule, or to have any powers.
They say, said Io from the shadows, that there's an island where the rule of justice is kept as it was under the kings. Mored's Isle, they call it. But it's not Enlad of the kings, nor Ea. It's south, not north of Havnor, they say. There they say the women of the Hand have kept the old arts, and teach them, not keeping them secret each to himself, as the wizards do.
Maybe with such teaching you could teach the wizards a lesson, Mead said.
Maybe you can find that island, said Io. Otter looked from one to the other. Clearly they had told him their own greatest secret and their hope.
Mored's Isle, he said.
That would be only what the women of the Hand call it, keeping its meaning from the wizards and the pirates. To them, no doubt, it would bear some other name.
It would be a terrible long way, said Mead.
To the sisters and all these villagers, Mount On was the world, and the shores of Havnor were the edge of the universe. Beyond that was only rumor and dream.
You'll come to the sea, going south, they say, said Io.
He knows that, sister, Mead told her. Didn't he tell us he was a ship carpenter?
But it's a terrible long way down to the sea, surely, with this wizard on your scent. How are you to go there?
By the grace of water that carries no scent, Otter said, standing up. A litter of walnut shells fell from his lap, and he took the hearth broom and swept them into the ashes.
I'd better go.
There's bread, Io said. And Mead hurried to pack hard bread and hard cheese and walnuts into a pouch made of a sheep's stomach. They were very poor people. They gave him what they had. So Anyab had done.
My mother was born in Endlane, round by Faliern Forest, Otter said. Do you know that town?
She's called Rose, Rowan's daughter.
The carters go down to Endlane summers.
If somebody could talk to her people there, they'd get word to her. Her brother, Little Leash, used to come to the city every year or two. They nodded.
If she knew I was alive, he said.
Anyab's mother nodded. She'll hear it.
Go on now, said Mead.
Go with the water, said Io. He embraced them, and they him, and he left the house. He ran down from the straggle of huts to the quick, noisy stream he had heard singing through his sleep all his nights in Wood Edge. He prayed to it.
Take me and save me, he asked it.
He made the spell the old changer had taught him long ago, and said the word of transformation. Then no man knelt by the loud running water, but an otter slipped into it and was gone.